Colossians chapter 4. Now, I have to make a confession to you. I dreaded coming to this chapter of Colossians because, as with pretty much all of Paul's epistles, the last chapter to me is just plain boring. It's all this juicy, good theological stuff, you know, in the beginning and the middle. And then the last chapter is always, oh, and say hi to so-and-so, and give my greetings to so-and-so, and tell so-and-so I'm praying for him. Tell so-and-so that make sure you read my letter. And it's like housekeeping sorts of things. It's like, how do you teach that? Well, I have to eat some humble pie because I have found this chapter to be absolutely fascinating. And I hope that comes through a little bit as we go through it this morning. So let's go to Colossians chapter 4. Colossians chapter 4, and we'll begin in verse 2. Verse 1 belongs to the chapter before. He says, devote yourselves to prayer, keeping alert in it with an attitude of thanksgiving. Devote yourselves to prayer. I imagine if I were to ask you, what is it that you devote yourselves to? You might say, study, missions, service, teaching. Probably very few of us would say prayer. I know I wouldn't. Because prayer is a discipline I am still working on. I'm not very good at. But Paul says to devote yourselves to prayer. After all, if we're going to be talking to people about God and studying about God and learning about God, shouldn't we be talking to God and listening to Him? And it says to devote yourselves to prayer, keeping alert in it. Keeping alert in it. And those of you who participate in prayer, you know how it's easy to allow your mind to wander, to allow it to go this way and that way. You know, it's easier to rearrange furniture in my house than to rearrange thoughts in my head. Because the difficult work for me is to keep my thoughts on track. It is a mental discipline. It is mental weightlifting. And it's a tough thing to do, but oh, the value and the strength you get out of it if we just will participate in it. But do it with an attitude of thanksgiving. He mentions thanksgiving back up in chapter 3. In verse 15, and in 16, and in 17, and then again here in chapter 4, verse 2. And I really believe one of the forgotten things, one of the things that's weak in believers today, is an attitude of thanksgiving. Boy, we can see what's wrong with our lives, with the world, with things around us. But God give us eyes to see what's right with ourselves and with the world. And with those around us. And be thankful for it. And he says, verse 3, praying at the same time for us as well, that God will open up to us a door for the word, so that we may speak forth the secret of Messiah. Now, the secret of Messiah we discussed last week, up earlier in chapter 4, and I think it's mentioned also back at the end of chapter 1. And we won't go over that again. But this was Paul's mission, to share the secret of Messiah with the world, for which I have also been imprisoned. Now, let's stop there for a second. How did Paul get himself imprisoned? I want us to go back and review that for a moment. And you need to go back to Acts chapter 22. Acts 22. From Acts 22 on to the end of Paul's life, he's a prisoner. And what happened in Acts chapter 22? This is a real turning point in the book of Acts and in the history of the first century community and in the history of Israel, actually. What has happened is that in chapter 21, Paul has shown up at the temple. Some people have recognized him, and they say, oh, this is the guy who's caused all this desecration and this and that, and he spoke all these false things. And this riot started, and so the Roman soldiers come down from the fortress there, the Antonia Fortress, which is attached right to the northwestern corner of the temple. They start coming down the steps into the courtyard and grabbing Paul, and they're walking him up the steps. And then, as they're going up, Look at chapter 20, verse 37. As Paul was about to be brought into the barracks, he said to the commander, this Roman soldier, "May I say something to you?" And he said, "Do you know Greek? Then you are not the Egyptian who some time ago started..." You know, this Roman commander thinks Paul is this Egyptian guy who was a troublemaker. But he's talking to the soldier in Greek. And the guy who made this revolt, blah, 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 blah. Verse 39, then Paul said, "I am a Jew of Tarsus in Cilicia, a citizen of no insignificant city, and I beg you, allow me to speak to the people." When he had given him permission, Paul, standing on the stairs, get the picture now, thousands of people in the courtyard of the temple. Stairs going up the Antonia Fortress. Paul's maybe halfway up the staircase and stops, has his conversation. And Paul, standing on the stairs, motioned to the people with his hand. And then when there's a great hush, he spoke to them in the Hebrew dialect, saying, so he's speaking in Hebrew. And he says, "Brethren and fathers, hear my defense, which I now offer to you." And when they heard that he was addressing them in the Hebrew dialect, they became even more quiet. And he said, "I am a Jew, born in Tarsus of Cilicia, but brought up in this city, educated under Gamaliel, strictly according to the Torah of our fathers, being zealous for God, just as you all are today." And then he goes on to start telling his testimony. And all the way through, they're quiet and listening. He says, verse 4, "I persecuted this way to the death, binding, putting both men and women into prison, as also the high priest and all the council of the elders can testify. From them I also received letters to the brethren." He goes on and on. Then in verse 6, he says, "But it happened that as I was on my way, approaching Damascus about noontime, a very bright light suddenly flashed from heaven all around me. I fell to the ground and heard a voice saying to me, 'Shaul, Shaul, why are you persecuting me?' And I answered, 'Who are you, Master?' And he said to me, 'I am Yeshua the Nazarene, whom you are persecuting.'" Now you'd think that right there all the people say, "Kill him!" But they didn't. They remained quiet. They're listening. They say, "Okay, let's hear more." Verse 9, "And those who were with me saw the light, to be sure, but did not understand the voice of the one who was speaking to me. And I said, 'What shall I do, Lord?' And the Master said to me, 'Get up and go on to Damascus, and there you will be told all that has been appointed for you to do.' But since I could not see because of the brightness of that light, I was led by the hand by those who were with me and came into Damascus. A certain Ananias, a man who is devout by the standard of the Torah and well spoken of by all the Jews who live there, came to me and, standing near, said to me, 'Brother Shaul, receive your sight.' And at that very time, I looked up at him, and he said, 'The God of our fathers has appointed you to know his will, and to see Hatzadik, the righteous one, and to hear an utterance from his mouth.'" And the people are still listening. And they realize Hatzadik, the righteous one, is a reference to Yeshua. And they still listen. "For you will be a witness for him to all men of what you have seen and heard. Now, why do you delay? Get up and be immersed and wash away your sins, calling on his name." Whose name? Yeshua's name. All the people are still listening. No problems. No shouts. No demonstrations. They're listening to every word and receiving it. Verse 17, "It happened when I returned to Jerusalem and was praying in the temple that I fell into a trance, and I saw him saying to me, 'Make haste and get out of Jerusalem quickly, because they will not accept your testimony about me.' And I said, 'Master, they themselves understand that in one synagogue after another, I used to imprison and beat those who believed in you. And when the blood of your witness Stephen was being shed, I also was standing by approving and watching out for the coats of those who were slaying him." They stoned Stephen. And all the people are still listening. Not saying that's a bum rap. They're not saying, "Oh no, that's not true." They listened to every word, still receiving and accepting. Then in verse 21, this is what he says. "And he said to me, 'Go, for I will send you far away to the Gentiles.'" That's as far as Paul got. They listened to him up to this word. And then they raised their voices and said, "Away with such a fellow from the earth, for he is not fit to live." You see, when Paul referred to Gentiles, Gentiles coming to faith, they said, no, that's where we draw the line. Think about that for a moment. They could listen to the truth about Yeshua, about Paul's awakening, and that it was Yeshua he was persecuting, that Yeshua is Tzaddik, the righteous one. They could hear that. They could listen to that. But the moment he refers to Gentiles coming to faith, he doesn't deserve to live. And from that moment on, Paul is a prisoner. He is in chains. And he gets shuffled around from one ruler to another ruler, for this trial to that trial, this jury, that jury. Finally, he's put on a boat, sent to Rome. He's imprisoned in Rome. But from this point on, that word right there, Gentiles, that's the word that put him in chains. Okay? I just want you to be aware of that. It's a significant thing to understand. But you know, it's a good thing Paul is imprisoned. If he hadn't been imprisoned, he would have written so many letters. We wouldn't have Colossians today if he hadn't been imprisoned. The problem is always the solution. So during these years of imprisonment, he writes letters. And we have many of them. Not all, but many. He refers in Colossians 4 here to a letter he wrote to Laodicea. We don't have that letter. The only letter to Laodicea we have in our Bibles is the one Yeshua dictated to John in Revelation chapter 3, about how they were lukewarm. He's about to spew them out of his mouth. So, back to Colossians 4. So as he says in verse 3, so that I may speak forth the secret of Messiah, for which I have also been imprisoned, that I may make it clear in the way I ought to speak. Conduct yourselves with wisdom toward outsiders, making the most of the opportunity, or redeeming the time, is how it is literally appears in the Greek. Let your speech always be with grace, as though seasoned with salt, so that you will know how you should respond to each person. Let's analyze those. I don't like the term witnessing, because we're witnesses, but we're called to be ambassadors from one king to a foreign country. Our loyalties are with our king, who's going to establish his kingdom on this earth. In the meantime, we're in a foreign country, representing this king and bringing his message to those around us. And Paul mentions four things that we should incorporate in the way we are ambassadors, how we share the truth of his word. The first thing he says is walk in wisdom. In other words, before you say anything about talking, and notice speaking isn't until down number 3. The first thing is walking. Walk in wisdom. Not in religion, but in wisdom. How many times have you witnessed to someone, or someone is trying to share the gospel with you, and it wasn't wise the way they did it? I shared with you before, I'll never forget. We were at breakfast at a restaurant not far from here. And we were some Christian friends of ours. So here we are, we're all believers sitting at this table. There's about 6 or 7 of us sitting at this table. And I noticed this one odd-looking elderly woman at the table over there who just was all by herself. And later I figured out why she was all by herself. And she's just there. And I saw her just kind of, you could tell she's just tense, you know, and just kind of all closed in and locked up. And I just kept looking over at her, and I thought, and she had her back to everybody. And so we're having our breakfast, they've cleared our plates, we're sitting around talking, and then the little old lady gets up, and she walks over to our table, doesn't say a word, puts a tract on our table, goes back to her seat, sits down, and then she puts herself in an attitude of prayer. And the tract is something about how you can know you're going to heaven when you die. And I thought, something's really wrong with this picture. She didn't care to get to know us. She never smiled. She never introduced herself. She didn't. All we were, and she was wrong. I mean, we're all believers there. She wasted the track, perfectly good track, on people who had already read it. And She's trying to sell a car to someone who'd already bought it. And so it's like she was not discerning. She was not wise. And it was just like very off-putting. And I wonder about the people in the restaurant who saw this happen and what they must have thought. She didn't walk in wisdom. I've also shared with you about when I was probably in my late teens, early 20s, my family went to Nashville. I was single at the time, of course, and whenever I go to a city, I just love to walk it. Just walk it and see what it's all about. And so we made a time to meet up later, and I just started walking. And I turned this one corner, and then I realized I was on Honky Tonk Row. And it was just one bar after another after another. And everyone, the doors are open, you can hear country western music being played live coming out of that bar. Okay? And it was crowded. And then there were some other little shops that were not all that morally aligned. And but the street, the sidewalk's very crowded. So I thought, I'll just go down to the block, turn left, and get out of this section. And I was about halfway down the block, and I hear this loud preaching coming over these speakers. And real slowly, there's this big car comes up. It's got four of these big speakers, you know about the size of those, four of them, one going all four directions, mounted on the roof, blasting this hellfire brimstone sermon. And all over this black car are bumper stickers with Bible verses on them and things like turn or burn and things like that. All over it, the hood, the sides, the tail, the front, all over. And this guy, he's just driving real slow because he's saving souls. This is the, I don't know what you call this thing, the Bible mobile or something. And so I watched this and I thought, okay, maybe the message is right, but there's something really, really wrong about this whole picture. Because you could never get behind that wheel doing what he's doing. And I thought, what's wrong? And I'll never get the phrase spiritual pornography went through my mind. Spiritual pornography. You see, what is pictured by pornographic images is not necessarily bad things. It's just they shouldn't be pictured at all. There are certain things that are intimate and given by God, but they should be kept intimate. Now, this man wanted to be an effective ambassador. He should, first of all, walk instead of driving. He should have walked in wisdom. He should become a friend of sinners, not sitting in his air-conditioned car on a hot day in Nashville just blasting out hellfire brimstone sermons. And I thought, how about these musicians? They're in the bars playing their country western music. But do you think they appreciated this guy driving right past the door, drowning out their music? Now, granted, what he had to say, I'm sure it was more true, more accurate than what they were singing about. But how are they ever going to respond to that kind of a message, thinking, that's the guy who ruined my career. That's the guy who drowned out my music. You don't impose yourself on people. We have to be wise and polite and sensitive and discerning as we share the most precious thing in the universe, the secret of Messiah. And we have to walk in wisdom. And you can't teach that in a two-hour witnessing class. This is something that comes from a lifetime, however long your life is so far. You must take your experiences and the wisdom you've gained and use that as you are an ambassador for your Savior. Now, if you're visiting, you're welcome to ask questions and share comments. So let's get a microphone over to my lovely sister-in-law, Min. And there we go. Yes, Min.
Well, I had a thought came to my mind about you said that we need to live the life and we need to walk with the Messiah. I think about this word, and I don't know where it is, but I don't. It's called to be ready to give an answer.
Yes.
Yeah. It's 1 Peter 3:15.
1 Peter 3:15, right.
And that we need to be ready.
Yes.
It means that we don't go and start talking, or we need to be ready.
Right.
Because when people have questions,
yes,
you know, they'll come, and
right,
we need to be ready on top of our life with everything. And I am a big, big work in progress, and I feel like every day I'm not ready to open
yeah.
my house.
I understand.
That's just the thought that keeps me.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. You know, it says be ready with an answer, okay, concerning the hope that's in you. Well, what if nobody's asking the question? If nobody's asking the question, maybe they don't see your life being different. So if we're living a life that we should be living, people should be asking us questions. Let's go on to the next one here. Redeem the time. Now, the word for time in Greek is the word chronos. That's where we get the word chronology or chronograph, but that is not the word used here. The word used here is the word kairos, just like the Kairos prison ministry that we make cookies for and that Beth Tikkun supports. Kairos is a different word for time. It is the word that the Septuagint uses to translate the moed, appointed time. The moedim, you know, God's appointed times. In the Septuagint, they use the word kairos. So in other words, it doesn't just say redeem your time, but redeem the appointed times. In other words, recognize that when you have an encounter with someone and you're about to share the seed of the gospel, this precious truth, the secret of Messiah, recognize it as a divine appointment. You know, that guy driving the bagel mobile down the street or whatever it is, blasting out these sermons, he was not seeing anything as an appointed time. He was just gushing all this stuff out on people, and they're going, yuck, you know, I didn't ask for this. And it didn't change anybody. It just irritated people. But see that your encounter with someone who needs what you know as a divine appointment. It's a moed. And if it's a divine appointment, that means God is sovereign. He set up that appointment. He's the one who established it. I think we need to be careful to watch for these. I don't think going door to door is what God's called us to do. In fact, Messiah very specifically says, do not go from door to door. There you just irritate people. Encounter them. Become friends with them. Get to know them. Find out what concerns them. And recognize, redeem that time, invest in that time, and recognize it's something God has set up. Don't mess it up. And then it says, speak with grace. So you've walked in wisdom. You recognize it's something divine God has set up. And now it's time to speak, but do it with grace, not by rote. Do it with grace. And it says, your speech seasoned with salt. Make your words something that are tasty and not repulsive. One of the things I'm very careful to do, and I know I've been drilling it into you, is that there is no religious jargon in the Bible. You know, we've talked about that. And back a few years ago when we studied Acts, we took a few weeks as a run-up to our study of Acts. We started taking religious terminology that, if you grew up in church like I did, it just became part of your vocabulary. And we started going through this terminology to find out what the real word is behind it, the Hebrew and the Greek. And what you find out is if you were a native Hebrew reader or a Greek reader, you would not find any religious jargon at all in what you read. It was always the common vernacular. There are no religious terms. Even the word holy in Hebrew and Greek is not religious. Means set apart, set aside for some special purpose. That's all. So use the word set apart, set aside. Don't use the word holy. That's a religious word. Don't use religious talk when you talk. Use normal, everyday conversational words. Get rid of the words sanctification, which means to be made set apart. Get rid of the word salvation. Use the word rescue or help. Get rid of the word redemption. Purchase is the word. You purchased, you paid for it. That's what it means. So use the word that it means. Use the regular words people use. Otherwise, you're immediately putting up a religious barrier between you and the one you're trying to reach. You follow? All right, Walt, Tony, I see your hand up. So thank you, Bill.
And I think that one of the characteristics we miss is the joy of our salvation.
Oh, my, yes.
That is what we're not shown is the joy of our salvation.
Yeah.
That draws people to you when you're excited about your salvation, yeah, and what you've learned through the Word.
Yes.
We want to guide them and drag them along. Yeah, oh, that's the joy of our salvation.
Yes, that very good point. Yeah, it should. That's why I put down here, with grace, means self-composure, empathy, and humor. Have some joy for Pete's sake. This would be a very joyous occasion when you're imparting to someone. If it's good news, then be happy about it. You act like you're sharing bad news. So many people, when they witness this bad news, like that woman at the restaurant, she was miserable. She wasn't too excited about the good news. So anyways, yes, Jim. Let's get a microphone to Jim.
Why was the statement from God to Paul so distasteful to the Jews that he was to go to the Gentiles?
That's a good question. I should have addressed that back earlier. Because they saw the Gentiles as being their enemies, especially the Romans, who had built this fortress there and watching everything they did and taxing them to death. And they saw the Romans as the enemy. And so since the Romans, these Gentiles, are the enemy, all Gentiles are bad. But you think about it, almost all the pain and misery Israel has ever suffered, it's come from Gentiles, not from other Jews. And so they just saw it as being Gentiles are the enemy. Yeah. So. And Adam, yes. Thank you, Jim. That was a good question.
I was just thinking a little bit about the word appointed time, because as you're going through the teaching, I personally, I don't know if other people in the same place can help but reflect on times I've shared in the past. And I think about, luckily I managed to dodge a lot of, yeah, I guess, the experiences that people are causing, you know, getting pushed out and doing, yeah, stuff. But so many people think that it's your obligation, and it's almost like if you're not doing it, if you're not beating people in the head and throwing papers in their face and stuff, then you're probably going to hell because you're not a Christian. But realizing that there's this piece of the appointed time puzzle. And I look back and there's only one or two times I've really shared with somebody that's been truly anointed.
Yeah.
And where I'm like, all right, God wants me to do this one. And it's not me thinking, time to bring out my knowledge. Look at,
yeah,
I think it gets so cheesy sometimes. Like, my parents are like, oh, drop that smile. God, show them how heavy you are to be a believer.
Yeah.
And it's like, you can be human, and what God says before you is there. I don't know, just.
Yeah. Yeah, good point. Thank you, Adam. Very good. Good insight. All right. Anyone else? Yes, Sheridan. Bill, we're going to have to get you roller skates, buddy.
We don't want to waste away nothing. I'm thinking about a gentleman that I met during the week, a patient, and this whole concept of appointed times. And I'm sure Dr. Martin's also had this experience in his practice, but I sometimes meet people who have just devastating, mm-hmm, medical conditions, who you would think that they would just be miserable human beings who really, yeah, don't have much quality to their life. But I meet some people who have heavy, heavy burdens that they carry,
yeah,
difficult lives. This gentleman has been in a renal failure for 18 years, which is almost unheard of, Martin. 18 years.
Yeah.
Still alive, going to dialysis 3 times a week. I walked in the room to meet him, and I was hit with, I just knew I was in the presence of a holy man.
Yeah.
You know, and as we got to talking, I asked him, I said, how many divine appointments have you had over all these years, sitting in a dialysis chair 3 times a week with so many other patients going through the same thing? And I said, you know, God trusted you enough to give,
yeah,
you this burden. He blessed my heart that day.
Yes.
You know, I had a wonderful, wonderful conversation with this man. But, you know, he doesn't give us anything that
that's
we can't
do. Right.
And, you know, you just never know.
That's right. Well put. Yeah, in our modern culture, all the emphasis is put on physical health. If you don't have physical health, your life's not worth living. But they fail to see that real life is what's inside the body. And that life can thrive, and even in a broken body, a diseased body. All right, well, number four, know how to respond to each person. Now, this is the toughest one. This requires real discernment. But you can develop discernment, first of all, by listening. We sometimes, when we want to share the Lord, we focus on us doing the talking, they do the listening. But people don't care what you know until they know that you care. So listen. Listen to them. You know, we love reading the words in red where Yeshua is speaking. But how many times did he listen to other people first to really hear them out, to really know what's on going on inside? This takes patience and quiet and listening. And there's no such thing as discernment without love. Somehow love gives you x-ray vision into a person's heart. If you love a person, you can see into them. If you don't love them, they're closed. But love gives you eyes to see in, and we must choose to love people. And when the moment I was started to meditate on this, know how to respond to each person, I started thinking of two passages of Scripture, John 3 and John 4. In John 3, Yeshua meets Nicodemus, who's right at the top of the social ladder, one of the Sanhedrin. He comes to Yeshua at night, and they begin to talk about the kingdom. And Yeshua talks to him about being born from above, or being born again, is how our English versions put it. But in the next chapter, Yeshua goes to Samaria, and he meets the woman at the very bottom of the social ladder, the woman at the well. Both of them need the same thing. But boy, the conversations could not have been more different. They were worlds apart. Because to break down the walls in Nicodemus' life to get to the heart of what he needed took one path. But to help this woman clean out the well of her own soul took other words and a different conversation. Yeshua was so sensitive to the individual. And yet we want this one size fits all. And we treat the good news like it's a pill. Just swallow this and call me in the morning. And that's not how it works. That is not how it works. We must find out what the barrier is that person's put up between them and God and help them to disassemble that barrier. And different people have different barriers between them. Nicodemus had one. The woman at the well had a different one. So we need to find out what have they constructed between them and God. And then work with them, if they're open to it, to help them bring down the barriers between them and God. Because if there's anything between you and God, you put it there. Or somebody else did, but God didn't. All right? So I think these are four very important things. And Paul was not just talking off the top of his head. He's being very specific and methodical as he lays them out. Walk in wisdom. Redeem the time. Speak with grace, seasoning your speech with salt, and know how to respond to each person. In that order. Let's move on. As we blaze through chapter 4. Verse 7, as to all my affairs, I'm just going to read straight through this. We're going to go back and pick it apart. Tychicus, our beloved brother and faithful servant and fellow bondservant in the Master, will bring you information, for I have sent him to you for this very purpose, that you may know about our circumstances and that he may encourage your hearts, or comfort your hearts, is it also a good translation. And with them, Onesimus, our faithful and beloved brother, who is one of your number, they will inform you about the whole situation here. Aristarchus, my fellow prisoner, sends you his greetings. And also Barnabas's cousin Mark, about whom you received instructions. If he comes to you, welcome him. And also Jesus, Yahushua, who is called Justice. These are the only fellow workers. By the way, there are three different men in the New Testament, referred to the New Testament by the name Yeshua. Of course, there's Yeshua the Messiah. Then there's Joshua of the Tanakh, of the Old Testament. And then there's this third one who had the name Joshua. Okay? But in our English translations, they translate it Jesus. But his other name is Mark. His name is Justice. These are the only fellow workers for the kingdom of God who are from the circumcision. These are Jewish believers. And they have proved to be an encouragement to me. Epaphras, who is one of your number, a bond slave of Yeshua the Messiah, sends you his greetings, always laboring earnestly for you in his prayers, that you may stand complete and fully assured in all the will of God. For I testify for him that he has a deep concern for you and for those who are in Laodicea, which is only about 12 miles up the road, and Hierapolis. Luke, the beloved physician, this is the same Luke who wrote the Gospel of Luke, sends you his greetings, and also Demas. Greet the brethren who are in Laodicea, and also Nympha, and the assembly that is in her home. When this letter is read among you, have it also read in the churches, the assemblies of the Laodiceans, and you, for your part, read my letter that is coming from Laodicea. We don't have that letter today. I wish there was a book in our Bible called Laodiceans, but there isn't. Say to Archippus, take heed to the ministry which you have received in the Master, that you may fulfill it. I, Paul, write this greeting with my own hand. Remember my imprisonment. Grace be with you. So let's go back and go through these names. Verse 7, Tychicus. In Greek, it's pronounced Tychicus. That's why we say Tychicus instead. His name means fortuitous or fortunate. He's mentioned five times in the New Testament. He's a... look at the wrong place. Yes, five times. He's called a beloved brother, a faithful worker for the Lord, and a fellow bondservant. He's called the same thing in Ephesians 6:21, as well as here. And all we know about Tychicus is what it says. He was a brother to Paul, not a physical brother. He was a Greek. He was a Gentile. But Paul, the Jew, is calling this Gentile his brother. He's a beloved brother, faithful worker. He's a fellow bondservant. And then he refers to Onesimus. Now, Onesimus has a whole book written about him. Did you know that? Onesimus has an entire book written about him. The book of Philemon, or the letter to Philemon, is very short. It's only one chapter. It's all about Onesimus. Now, Onesimus, as far as we know, is a runaway slave. If you turn to Philemon, let's take a look there real quick. And if you can't find Philemon, you go to Hebrews and turn left. All right, it's right before Hebrews. It's only one chapter, and in verse 10, you know, Paul is given his greetings and so on, but in verse 10, he gets down to business, what the real purpose of his letter to Philemon is. And he says, I appeal to you for my child, my son, whom I have begotten in my imprisonment, Onesimus. In other words, Onesimus came to be a believer by knowing Paul. And that's why he calls him his son. Paul calls Timothy his son. You call believers sons if that believer is one you have discipled and grows up to see things you do, becomes a student, and starts living his life just like you. Then you call that one your son, because he resembles you. Who formerly was useless to you, but now is useful both to you and to me. And I have sent him back to you in person, that is, sending my very heart, whom I wish to keep with me, that in your behalf he might minister to me in my imprisonment for the gospel. But without your consent, I did not want to do anything, that your goodness should not be, as it were, by compulsion, but of your own free will. Now, what's going on? Reading between the lines, it would appear that Onesimus was a slave of Philemon. He was Philemon's property. These are Greeks now. These aren't Jews. These are Greeks. And Onesimus was his property, was a slave, and Onesimus ran away. And somehow he finds himself with Paul. And while he's with Paul, he becomes a believer. And then Paul sends Onesimus back to his owner. Now, at this time, if a slave runs away, that's a capital crime. So Onesimus has committed a capital crime by running away from Philemon. But Philemon's a believer. And now Onesimus is a believer. Paul calls him a beloved brother. His son, actually. And he says, I'm sending him back to you. And I'm trusting that you'll treat him like a brother as well. He's still your servant. But let's do the right thing. That's what Paul's appealing to. So let's continue on. Verse 15. For perhaps he was for this reason parted from you for a while, that you should have him back forever. In other words, the problem is the solution. No longer as a slave, but more than a slave, a beloved brother, especially to me, but how much more to you, both in the flesh and in the master. If then you regard me a partner, accept him as you would me. But if he has wronged you in any way or owes you anything, charge that to my account. I, Paul, am writing this with my own hand. I will repay it, lest I should mention to you that you owe to me even your own self as well. Because after all, you're one of my disciples. I'm the one who brought you to faith. So if you want to talk about who owes who, what you owe me is a whole lot more than what Onesimus may owe you. Yes, brother, let me benefit from you and the Master. Refresh my heart in Messiah. Okay? The whole letter of Philemon is about this, returning Onesimus to Philemon. And apparently, if Philemon accepted him, and everything was good, and he released him back to Paul's care to serve Paul and to be a companion to Paul and help him. Yes, Adam. Microphone to Adam, please.
I really try not to about that. But I had a note, it's something I struggled with the first time I read Philemon. Deuteronomy 23:15, there's a commandment that says, if a slave escapes to you, you shall not send him back to his master.
No.
And to me, it seems like Paul did exactly that. So I don't know what to do with that.
Yeah, I think that the commandment has more to do about if the slave is being persecuted or whatever, if he's being mistreated. I think the context seems to be that. But here Paul is, this is not under Jewish law in the land. This is outside the land of Israel. And when you see the word slave in the Torah, it's in a completely different context than a slave in the Gentile world. And I wish they wouldn't even use the same words, because slavery, so to speak, in the Torah is a completely different dynamic than slavery in ancient Greece and Rome. Completely different dynamic. And so the word should not even be the same. Shouldn't even be the same. So Paul recognizes that, of course, and he's treating the situation a little differently. Because now it's not master and slave relationship so much as it is two brothers and Messiah. And it turned out to be the wise decision. But I'm glad you brought that up. I'm sure others would have asked the same question. All right? By the way, Onesimus means profitable. And I don't think the meanings of these names are coincidental at all. Aristarchus means best ruler. He's also mentioned five times in the apostolic scriptures, just like Tychicus is. He's mentioned three times in Acts as Paul's traveling companion. He was shipwrecked with Paul on Malta. So this guy has been through it with Paul. If anybody had good reason to walk and say, enough of this, Aristarchus had that. And he was also in prison with Paul. He was a fellow prisoner with him. This guy was devoted. He and Tychicus seem to be very similar, but it's almost like Aristarchus has been through even more. Aristarchus has really been through it with Paul, but he's in it for the long haul. And then you've got Marcos, which means polite. He's mentioned eight times in the New Testament. He's a Jewish believer, and his other name is Yochanan. His Greek name is Marcus. His mother hosted a home assembly. You can read about that in Acts 12. Paul and Barnabas had a sharp disagreement whether to take Mark along with them on another journey. And you can read about that over in Acts chapter 15. This is what it says, in Acts 15, verses 37 to 39. And Barnabas was desirous of taking John, called Mark, along with them also. But Paul kept insisting that they should not take him along, who had deserted them in Pamphylia and had not gone with them to the work. So Marcos was a deserter. He had deserted the work, for whatever reason, left Paul, and now he had come back, and Barnabas says, let's take him along again. And Paul says, no, not taking him with me. And it says in verse 39, and there arose such a sharp disagreement that they separated from one another. Paul and Barnabas separated over this, and Barnabas took Marcos with him and sailed away to Cyprus. Well, apparently, Mark matured, and Paul's trust was restored, because you see here in verse 10, Colossians 4:10, that he refers to Barnabas's cousin Mark, and that might be why Barnabas wanted to cut Mark some slack. They were cousins. And he says, about whom he received instructions. If he comes to you, welcome him. So I'm not quite sure what that's about. We need more information to understand that. But in 2 Timothy 4:11, he also refers to Mark. He says, pick up Mark and bring him with you, for he is useful to me for service. So apparently their relationship was restored. And then you've got this Jewish believer whose name is Yeshua, Jesus in English, Jesus in Greek. His name means rescue. But he also had a Greek name, Justus, Eustace. And have you ever heard of someone named Eustace? It's the Greek form of the English Justus. Or Justus is the English form of the Greek Eustace. But it means upright, righteous, and just. Only found this one time in the New Testament. Now, this brings up something about Jewish Gentile names. Shaul's Hebrew name was Shaul, but his Greek name was Paulos. We have Yochanan, Greek name Marcos. And then we have Yeshua here, Greek name Eustace. Their names are not changed, but what you find is that Jews who live outside of Israel, they are born and given a Hebrew name when they're circumcised on the eighth day, but they're also given a Greek name. The same is true for Jews today. Jewish friends of mine, I'll sometimes ask them, well, what's your Hebrew name? And they'll tell me what their Hebrew name is. But Paul did not change his name from Shaul to Paul. He had both names, Hebrew name, Greek name. And whenever you see someone, and I think these are the only three examples, but whenever you find a Jew and it says, also called such and such, it's referring to the fact he's a Jew, but he has a Greek name as well. It's as simple as that. End of story. And then we have Epaphras, whose name means commended. He's mentioned three times. Now, he's originally from Colossae. This is his hometown. And he's the one who originally brought the good news to Colossae. Go back to chapter 1, verse 7. And it says, just as you learned it from Epaphras, our beloved fellow bondservant, who is a faithful servant of Messiah on our behalf. So this is why I believe he was especially diligent in prayer and burdened for the believers there. This was his home. These were his people. He was the one who brought the good news at first and has been teaching them and establishing them, and his heart is just burdened for these people. And then we've got Luke, which means light-giving. Mentioned three times. He's a physician, traveling companion with Paul, wrote the Gospel of Luke and Acts. He's Paul's biographer. He's a scholar. His Greek is the most sophisticated Greek of the Gospels. And you can tell this is a very educated man. A very learned man. And then we've got Demas. His name means popular. Remember that. It means popular. Mentioned three times. He was a fellow worker with Paul, but it tells us that he loved this present age or present world, and he deserted Paul. And you can find that information over in 2 Timothy 4. Verses 9 to 12, it says, make every effort to come to me soon, he tells Timothy. For Demas, having loved this present world, has deserted me and gone to Thessalonica. Demas deserted him. So here in Colossians, Demas is listed among his fellow workers. But in Timothy, which is very near the end of Paul's life when he wrote that, we find that he abandoned him. Interesting thing. Now, Demas means popular. What does Thessalonica mean? Because he went off to Thessalonica. It means victory of falsity. That's exactly how my dictionary puts it. But I think a better translation would be deception wins. Isn't that interesting? Demas, whose name means popular. Deception won. He was a washout. Now, when you take this cast of characters, I started thinking, how interesting. Kind of looks like a typical fellowship, doesn't it? You got some faithful workers. Some that have been older and been tested and even shipwrecked and gone through it. And you know, one of the things I've learned, I think I know people, but I found I don't know anyone until I see them tested, until I see our relationship tested in some way. And then I really know who they are. And I'm surprised sometimes by the people who fall away. I'm surprised sometimes by the people who prove to be so faithful. But until the testing comes, you don't know. It's like toothpaste. Until you squeeze the tube, you don't see what's inside. And people need squeezed. Then what's on the inside comes on the outside. You found the same thing true, I'm sure, haven't you? So you got these faithful companions. Then you have this guy who had a bad start, a runaway slave, but he repented. It became very valuable, and everything's restored. You have Epaphras, who's a faithful sower of the gospel, a prayer warrior, but he grows where he's planted. Mark, I kind of call Mark the preacher's kid. He fell away, but he came back. It caused some problems between Barnabas and Paul, but it was all healed up later. I call him the preacher's kid because it was his mother. I don't know where his father was, but his mother was having a home assembly of believers in her home, so he must have grown up and heard the truth and all of this, kind of like a preacher's kid. But boy, the attraction of the world, he fell away, but he came back. He returned. Then you've got the scholar, the guy who really, really is smart, he's educated, he writes, he studies, he researches. You don't need too many of those, it gets boring. But one's good, one or two. But then you always have a washout, a total washout. Mark was a washout who came back. Demas is a washout who didn't. And I thought, here you got this whole cast of characters. Kind of a typical congregation, isn't it? Things haven't changed much, have they? But, you know, we can't forget this one person who we know nothing about, who just happens to have the name Jesus. And I think that's dropped in there. I think the Holy Spirit purposely puts that there and tells us nothing about him, just to say that Yeshua is always present. He's always there. And I don't need to tell you any more right here about him. You know all about him. But he's there, and he sticks with you. Right? Isn't it amazing? So I found chapter 4 to me to be very fascinating, to really encourage me. Because sometimes, as you know my story, I never want to be a congregational leader. You got to be crazy to want to do this. But I find myself in this position, and as a result, I have this such a burden for you, for the people who attend here. And it's a constant burden. It's bearable, but it's always a burden because my heart goes out to you. And I pray for you. You're always in my mind, even when we're not talking or calling. And I care about you. And I spent most of my life not caring about anybody but me. Then Robin invaded my world. I cared about her, so that made two of us. But I never saw a day I care about so much for so many. And so I sometimes take it personally when I see things fall out. People fall away. People drift off. People make accusations, this and that. But then going back and looking at chapter 4, I thought, I guess this is pretty standard procedure. And my experience is not all that unusual. And so I thank God for chapter 4 of Colossians. And it's been a comfort to me, an encouragement. And I see, yes, Tony. Let's get a microphone to Tony here. Sure.
Now, Demas is a washout.
Yeah.
But He knew the gospel. He knew the Lord, but he fell back into the world.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I would say he hadn't lost his salvation. Am I right on that?
If you're defining salvation as going to heaven when you die instead of hell, then no. But he lost the victory in this life. And remember, in the scriptures, this brings up a good point. Salvation, whenever you see the word save or salvation in the New Testament scriptures, it is not talking about the afterlife. It's not talking about the afterlife. It's talking about this life. Walking in light and in victory here. That is what salvation is. It's never talking about that. It's talking about this. That's taken care of. Question is, what are you doing now? Okay? So, I'd say he lost his victory. No question about it. He failed miserably. But on Judgment Day, God will say, Demas, you know you washed out back there? Yeah, I know. I use that. I use that to encourage Grant 2,000 years later. And a whole host of people, because they realize some people come back, some don't, but they realize that this sometimes happens. And I use you. You're still in my scriptures. And I put you there because I use you to teach. And I'm going to reward you for that. At least that's my take on it. Because Paul does say in Corinthians that every man will receive praise from God. So maybe that'll be Demas's praise. Yes, Rick has a question up here, or a comment.
Just a comment about the last question. I think these are pictures that are a moment in time.
Yes.
Paul is writing this letter, and these are the circumstances.
Yeah.
Then.
Yeah.
We don't know what happens to these.
That's true.
One
can only hope.
Yeah.
God left us hanging, though. And Paul left us hanging. So, a very good point. Yeah, it might very well have had a happy ending. Who maybe he helped to witness to people in Thessalonica, I don't know. But it's interesting to think about. So, we finished Colossians. You know, I encourage you, I hope you'll do this week, maybe this afternoon. Go back and just read straight through it. It's four chapters, not a very long book. I remember we started the first chapter with the question, what does God look like? And we see these attributes of God. And then Paul begins to talk about these are the attributes that were embodied in Messiah himself. But then he says, but you are also able to bear these attributes yourself. Because God has performed an incredible change in the fabric of the universe when Messiah died and rose from the dead. Everything's changed. Now start to walk in light of that change that he has brought about. And the sin of Adam has been undone. So walk as children of the new Adam. Walk in the freedom of the victory that's yours. Don't walk in the light of what your eyes can see. Walk in the light of my word. Because I'm telling you reality. If you walk in the reality of what I'm telling you, life will never be the same. And then he finishes with practical advice in chapter 3. And then this personal insight into his own circumstances at the moment with these other friends of his. So it's moved from the spiritual realm, the loftiness of the spiritual realm, right down to the nitty-gritty of walking in this world. It's an amazing book. It covers a lot of territory in four short chapters. I encourage you to go back and get the whole picture now. And also on the website, remember I mentioned about the bunny trails, rabbi trails, I call them. I will have a paper there like I did for Hebrews where it takes Colossians, condenses it down to a paragraph, taking the rabbi trails out. So it gives you just the main thrust of what the book is about. Okay, so I'll put that on the website tomorrow as well so you can read Colossians in one breath. All right, that'll be there. Any last moment comments or questions? Are we good? Okay, and I don't see Tim here, but Tara, I want you to thank Tim for suggesting the study of Colossians. It has really been a blessing to me. So I'm thanking for that. I wasn't all that thrilled when he first mentioned it. Colossians? But I'm so grateful that God put that on his heart. So let's close in prayer. Father, thank you so much for your blessings and your goodness to us. Thank you for the precious and holy words of Paul in this short little book that says so much. It's so big. It's bigger on the inside than on the out. But Lord, as we look over these characters, I pray we would see ourselves as a Tychicus or an Aristarchus or a Luke or an Epaphras, one who is faithful, one who is just faithful, so that Messiah returns, he will find faithfulness in the earth. So Lord, help us to be faithful to the end, to finish strong, to cross the finish line in strength. And we'll give you all the glory for the amazing adventure that we lived out in this life. We praise you for it in Yeshua's name.